For the last several Sunday mornings, I've been retelling the story of the life of Christ. There are far too many details to try to tell it with all its detail. But we can take certain snapshots and try to link them together and emerge from this with a retelling, a re-imaging for ourselves of what it was like. We started with his early life, his baptism, and then followed with his temptation, then with his teaching and what drew people to him. And last Sunday we looked at his opponents, why people turned against him. Today I want to follow that with a look at the last week of his life, leading down to his arrest and trial. Mark and Luke both tell in their Gospels of a decision Jesus made to leave Galilee, where things were calm and peaceful, and to go to Judea, where he knew what he must face, certain death. Mark tells it in the 10th chapter, verse 32. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed him were afraid. You have to draw a picture in your mind of their walking 100 to 150 miles from Galilee to Jerusalem, going across the Jordan River, coming down the east side, crossing back at Jericho, and just making a slow trek with Jesus stopping in every village and teaching people on the way, healing many people. A great many of his followers came to him during this period. It was a decisive period. It probably was a journey that took 6 weeks or more. He could have stayed behind and have found peace. Instead, he goes to Jerusalem where the storm is gathering. Luke tells the same story in chapter 9 and spends his next 9 chapters of his gospel on this one journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. When the days drew near for him to be received up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. You almost have to picture a face set in granite, with disciples coming behind who don't understand what's going on, why he would go back to the area where it's so late that they'd tried to stone him, and make his stand there again. Leslie Weatherhead, in his story of the life of Christ, says that there were only about 3 options open to Jesus at this moment anyway. He could flee, or he could fight, or he could face them. So he went to Jerusalem to face the opposition and to take his stand as leader of the people. When he arrived in the city, it was on a Sunday, the last week of his life. That's the reason many people call it Palm Sunday. When he rode into the city, they broke down palm tree leaves and limbs and spread them before him along with their clothing as he rode into the city. But that's to get a little bit ahead of the story. As he made his journey toward Jerusalem, he could expect a number of things when he got there. That face set toward the city, knowing what would happen. One of the things he'll find is a crowd, a huge crowd of people. There were 3 feasts every year that every male Jew was required to be present for. One was Passover, one was Pentecost 50 days later, so lots of them stayed in Jerusalem for that 7-week period. And the other was Tabernacles, which came in the fall, celebration of the Israelites living in tents in the wilderness as they journeyed from Egypt to Canaan. The Passover feast was the high peak of that year of festivity. In the AD 60s, Nero, king of the Roman Empire, used to look with contempt on the Jewish people. He thought they were a rather unimportant nation. And Cestius, the governor of Palestine, decided he would try to convince Nero of just how important the Jews were. And he did this by taking a census of the people who came for the Passover feast. He thought if he could convince Nero of how many of them would assemble on an important occasion like this, he would perhaps lead him to understand their importance. So Cestius gave an order to the priests to count the number of people in Jerusalem for the Passover. The priests hardly knew how to go about it, but Josephus, the first century historian, says they counted the lambs that were offered as sacrifices at the Passover, and they came up with the figure 256,500 lambs slaughtered. Josephus goes on to say that the minimum number of people to eat from one lamb slain at the Passover would be 10. Sometimes as many as 20 people would eat. And Cestius figured, with the help of the priests, a group of pilgrims in Jerusalem numbering 2,700,200 at the Passover feast that year. Now, I think that's probably an exaggeration, a figure beyond the appropriate number. Jerusalem is not a large city, as we know large cities today, and to put nearly 3 million people into it would seem impossible. And yet, when Jesus got there, he could expect to find tremendous crowds. He could also expect to find danger. They had attempted to stone him last time he was there. His coming would make it manifest that he was willing to assume leadership of the people again at whatever cost. So having walked 100 to 150 miles over a 6-week period, depending on how far he walked as he went across the Jordan River and came not on a direct route, but in a circuitous route to the city. He chose to ride a donkey in the last 2 miles into the city from near Bethany. Why? Was he tired? Well, he may have been. Jericho was 17 miles away. When he came through there was such a crowd following that blind Bartimaeus heard the crowd passing by, asked what was going on, was told it was Jesus of Nazareth who was passing by, and cried out for Jesus to have mercy on him and to heal him. Zacchaeus climbed that sycamore tree to see him above the crowd. But when you leave Jericho and go up to Jerusalem, 17 miles, you also climb 3,000 feet in elevation. Jericho is near the Dead Sea, which is the lowest spot on earth. You go from there to Jerusalem, which is some 2,700 feet above sea level. And so you have a rather stiff climb. It would take at least 5 hours to walk that distance. But I don't think Jesus rode the last couple of miles because he was tired. Zechariah had said in Zechariah 9, verse 9, "Your king comes to you lowly and riding on an ass." It was Jesus' way of entering the city in humility, even though he was to be king of the people. It was one of those prophetic ways of doing things. You remember how Ahijah came to Jeroboam when Jeroboam was going to take over 10 tribes from Solomon's son Rehoboam in a split of Israel. He took off Jeroboam's new garment, ripped it into 12 pieces, handed him 10 of them, and said, "You'll rule 10 of the tribes." Or you remember how Jeremiah told the Israelites they'd wear the yoke of Babylonian captivity? He made a yoke, put it around his own neck, wore it through the city of Jerusalem constantly. The prophets would often show people things when they wouldn't listen. If you won't hear, at least you'll see. And that's what Jesus did. As he came into the city with that crowd following him and a tremendous crowd waiting there, he rounded the Mount of Olives to a spot where for the first time the city became fully visible. Now, you've ridden into a city coming around a hill or off a mountain, or perhaps you've flown into a city by night and you've seen that sea of lights. You know something of the impact of seeing a massive city all at once. Jesus sees that city and the people are following him with such glee, so happy that the king is coming. And he pauses and weeps. The second time in the Gospels he's ever described as weeping. Luke 19:41, part of the text this morning. The word there is not the same word that was used when he wept at Lazarus' tomb either. This word is a much stronger word. It implies audible weeping, visible sobbing over the city. "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thee together as a hen doth gather chicks under her wings, but you wouldn't. Your house is left to you desolate. If you'd only known the things that belong to your peace." It must have been a strange thing. Everybody else so happy. "Hosanna to him who comes in the name of the highest." Breaking into shouts and song, reciting the Hallel Psalms of the Old Testament. "Here's the king." And the king stops and cries. But that's the entry of Jesus into Jerusalem on Sunday. When he came, he went straight to the temple, just like it was home. Went inside the temple, Mark 11:11, and looked around and beheld all the things that were there and turned and walked out. Went back to the city of Bethany, 2 miles out, suburb of Jerusalem. Spent the night, probably with his friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. The next day came back into the city. It's Monday. This time he goes straight to the temple again. But he doesn't look around and walk out. He takes his whip and he begins to drive out the money changers and the salesmen of animals. And we begin to wonder what's going on there and why does he do it? Well, you've never been in a church building, I suppose. I haven't, where there were hucksters trying to sell everything they could, where there were animals all around as if it were some kind of fair or market. But pilgrims have come from other lands, and the law says that they're to offer sacrifices to God. In Leviticus 12, verses 6 through 8, if a woman isn't able, when she offers her sacrifice after the birth of a child, to offer a lamb and a turtle dove, she offers 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. So it was a common thing to have the birds or to have animals that were guaranteed to be fit for sacrifice, and you don't have to bring them with you from wherever you live away from Jerusalem. And then there was that temple tax. The temple tax was a half shekel, about 16 pence. A day's work was 8 or 9 pence. There was just one special regulation in Jewish tradition. You had to use a coin that didn't have a king's head on it. Because after all, Jerusalem is being ruled by foreign power, and they would have nothing in the temple tax that implied any kind of foreign power. There was no king in David's line. They wanted nobody else's image on the coins that were put in the temple tax. And so men would stand and change them a Galilean coin or a temple shekel so they could make the tax payment, which was an annual thing for every male Jew who had reached adulthood. If they changed smaller coins into the temple tax, they charged them 2 pence. If they changed larger coins into temple tax, they charged them 4 pence. Half a day's wages. Somebody was raking off a good bit from the top. When Solomon dedicated that temple in 1 Kings 8:41 through 43, he prayed to God that whenever a foreigner would come and stand and pray toward that temple, God would hear him. He wanted all nations to know that the God of Israel is the God of the whole world. And around that temple there were courts. The court of the Jews, where every Jew who was not a priest could come. The court of women, where Jewish women could come. And then the court of the Gentiles, where the foreigner could come, presumably, and pray toward God. But there weren't too many foreigners. Nobody was trying to get them there anyway. So you use that court, the court of the Gentiles, as a place to make money during the feast time. Jesus couldn't stand it. He treated the temple as if it belonged to him. He drove them out. And he went back home to spend the night in Bethany. The next day he came back to the city. It's Tuesday. He was met immediately by a delegation who said, "Tell us by what authority you do these things." And Jesus said, "You tell me, by what authority did John baptize?" And they said, "We can't tell," after talking it over. "If we say authority of men, the people may fall out with us or even stone us. If we say the authority of God, he's going to want to know why we weren't baptized." "We can't answer." Jesus said, "I'm not going to tell you by what authority I do these things either." And he went on. And then several delegations came to him. They had their grapevine. News had spread through Jerusalem. So the Pharisees and Herodians came with a coin, and they said, "Tell us, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar or not?" Jesus said, "Let me see your coin. Whose image is that? Whose superscription? Caesar's? Then give it to Caesar. Give God what is God's." Trying to drive him into a compromising position, politically or religiously, to get him to say something in favor of a foreign power or to make him look like a rebel against foreign power. Then the Sadducees came. "We had a woman who married a man and he died." You know the Levirate law of the Old Testament. His brother has to marry her and try to bring up seed to his name. She went through 7 brothers. They all died. No child was born. But whose wife is she going to be if there's a resurrection, when all 7 had her? Jesus said, you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. In the resurrection, they won't marry. They won't be given in marriage. They'll be like the angels of God. And another controversy is over. A fourth group came and they said, "Which is the great commandment of the law?" And that's when Jesus talked to them about loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It was a teaching day, but a tense day, a day of controversy. He told several parables that day. Parable of the man who had 2 sons. He said, "Go work in my vineyard." One said, "I'm not going." Later he repented and went. The other said, "I go, sir," but he went not. Which did the will of the Father? He was reminding people, it isn't enough to say I'm doing God's will. You better be doing God's will. He told them the parable of the talents, the parable of the virgins, the story of the judgment in the form of sheep and goats being divided right hand and left. There's one parable that shows up in all 3 of the Gospels except John. You can tell that they recount different events. Something was more impressive to one than it was to the other. But when all of them tell the same event, it must have been a striking event. Jesus told that parable of the wicked husbandman. A certain man built a vineyard, hedged it about with a thicket hedge, put up a tower to watch against vandalism, dug a wine vat or press, let it out to tenants, went into a foreign country. Periodically, he sent servants back to get the revenue from his vineyard. That was a common thing. Everybody knew of absentee landlords who made their money off the land even while they were away on a vacation or an extended visit. But they took those servants when they came after the money and killed them one at a time. The man finally said, "I'll tell you, they keep killing my servants, I'll send my son. They'll respect him." But when the son came, they killed him too. Jesus said, "Do you know what the owner of that vineyard is going to do to those wicked servants?" And they began to see the lesson. Israel was God's vineyard, Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, and several other passages in the Old Testament. God had left her to produce revenue in the sense of bringing forth the kind of fruit that ought to be produced in life. He'd sent prophet after prophet to her, and they'd killed him. Now he'd sent his own son. They were going to kill him. And God would take away that vineyard from those people and give it to another nation bringing forth the fruits. And when you said to Jewish people that God's going to take it away and give it to Gentiles, you have an extremely controversial situation. And that's Tuesday. Jesus goes home to Bethany. The next day he does not go into the city. It's Wednesday. He stays in Bethany and eats dinner at the home of Simon the leper. Mark 14 tells the story, beginning with verse 1. A dinner in those days could be a very public thing. One would eat in a courtyard or a garden, and after the meal was over, guests or people in the neighborhood could come in, just sit around, hear the table talk. And so a lady came in. She had an alabaster box full of ointment. Women wore those things around their necks, often on chains in those days. Bottles of highly concentrated perfume. They'd open them occasionally, take out one drop and apply it, and then close it back quickly. But this woman brought in her alabaster box of ointment and just broke it and poured it all over the head of Jesus. And the disciples stood around and said, "Why this waste? That could have been taken and sold and the money given to the poor. It would have brought 300 pence. That's awfully hard to say what pence are worth nowadays. 8 pence would be a day's wages. I don't know exactly what it would have been worth, 300 pence, because you'd have to multiply it 30, 50, maybe 100 times to get it into our language. But I do know that when Jesus had 5,000 people following him one day, and he told his disciples to feed them, Philip said, "What with? If we had 200 penny worth of bread, it wouldn't be enough for all these people." Philip thought if he had 200 pence, he might go into the city and buy enough bread to make a start with 5,000 people. If you think of a bottle of perfume costing enough to feed 5,000 people, you begin to get an idea that it was a very expensive vial. But Jesus' response when they criticized her was, "Leave her alone." Quoting Deuteronomy 15:11, which says, "The poor will never vanish from the land," Jesus begins to remind them, "You always have the poor with you. She's anointed me for my burial. Wherever the gospel is told, preached, this story will be told of her." It was the anointing, the extravagance of love. Sometimes you know you'll never have the chance again. You either show your love now or never. And so you become quite extravagant about it. And that's what she did. When a person died, they'd wash the body, pour the perfume on, and sometimes break the flask and leave it in the tomb. And that's the picture Jesus saw in what she'd done. One of the strange things is that on the same day, Wednesday, that this woman anointed him at the house of Simon the leper, Judas went into the city and made his contact with the chief priest. "What will you give me that I will betray him into your hands?" They'd already given order in the closing verses of John 11 that if anybody knew where he was when he came to the feast, to report him so they could arrest him and kill him. Judas said, "I'll deliver him into your hands." And the bargain was made. Why? Judas has always been an anomaly. I suppose he always will be. Some have supposed Jesus chose him on purpose so he could have a traitor in the group because somebody had to betray him to fulfill the prophecies. That seems to me to be an awfully fatalistic view of what happened to Judas. Matthew, Mark, and Luke never mention the man's name from the time he's chosen to be one of the 12 until the end when he betrays Jesus. We only learn about him through some snapshots in the Gospel of John. In John 6, when Jesus had fed the 5,000 and then taught them the lesson on the bread of life, many turned back and walked no more with him. He said to the 12, "Will you also go away?" And Peter said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." And that's when Jesus, in the conversation, said, "Haven't I chosen you all? And one of you is a devil." A warning to Judas. John 12, John tells us that Judas was the treasurer. He kept the bag for the disciples and frequently stole money out of it. Finally, when the Passover was instituted, Jesus gives the sop to Judas. That's the morsel of food the host gives to the guest of honor. It seems to be a final appeal, a gesture of friendship and love. And then he says to Judas, "What you do, do quickly." It's almost as if he authorizes Judas to go out. Surely, going out with Jesus' own approval, he'll have second thoughts. But he didn't. Why did he do it? Old Summit thought he did it for money. He settled for a small amount, 30 pieces of silver. Others have thought he did it for fear, tried to save his own skin. He could see the storm gathering around Jesus. He wanted to be free, be on the other side, maybe so. But he took his own life a short time afterward. Others have thought it was bitterness. He was disappointed because Jesus hadn't established a physical kingdom. Still others have noted that Judas Iscariot means Judas of Kerioth. That's a village in Judea. He appears to be the only one of the 12 from Judea. The rest are Galileans from the province in the north. Was he angry because he didn't get in the inner circle where James and Peter and John were, the three closest to Jesus? Still others have thought he was trying to force Jesus' hand. I know what you'll do if you're ever put to the test. You're delaying it. I'm going to put you in a position where you'll have to take a stand and establish your kingdom. I don't know. I suspect the reason is to be found somewhere in that group. But Judas betrayed him. The next day, Thursday, evidently after 6 p.m., which makes it Friday by the Jewish calendar, he goes back into the city of Jerusalem the last time. This time he goes to observe the Passover with his disciples before he's killed. He tells his disciples, apparently there had been a prearranged signal, to go and they'd find a man with a water pot. They'd already gone earlier and found a colt, and they'd said the master has need of it, and the colt had been released for them. Now they're to find a man carrying a water pot, and they're to say to him, the master wants us to prepare the Passover feast for him, and he would take them to his house and let them prepare it. That seems a little strange until you know something of Eastern customs. Women carry the water pots. To see a man carrying a water pot would be as strange as to see a man carrying a lady's umbrella today. It wouldn't be hard to identify at all. And houses in those days, if they had two rooms, were built like boxes, one on top of another. The small room was set on top of the larger room below. And it was used as a guest chamber or a place to relax or maybe a place where the rabbi could come with a small group of students and conduct his classes. And so Jesus goes to that upper room to observe the Passover feast. Preparations had all been made. They sat around that table. Judas went out into the night. And Jesus took some of the bread still on the table and some of the cup. And he began to talk about this bread being broken, which is my body, and this cup being poured out, which is my blood. The longer I look at that, the more it impresses me. Right now, we're in a period where people are talking about death more than I can ever remember or read of. A number of people have made special studies of dying patients. And they believe they've come up with certain ways to help a person face a terminal illness. We sit and talk about death at great length. Help the person get out his fears and anxieties. Jesus didn't give a discourse on death. He didn't tell his disciples what it means to feel like you're going to die in a few hours. Instead, he taught a very vivid lesson. You know, your memory plays tricks on you. Sometimes you forget things you ought to remember. This is one thing you're going to have to remember. I want you to take bread, the very stuff of life, and break it, the symbol of death. And remember that that's the way my body was broken for you. And I want you to take the cup and every time remember the blood that was shed for you. Then it was time to go out. Starting as if they were going back to Bethany, he stopped in that garden to pray. But that's the last week down to the arrest and trial. The entry into Jerusalem on Sunday, cleansing of the temple on Monday, the controversies and the teaching of the temple on Tuesday, the dinner in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper on Wednesday, with the betrayal taking place behind his back, and the Passover supper on Thursday. Face set toward Jerusalem. I think, had it been me, I would have decided to give it another year. Maybe people will get more accustomed to what I'm saying and doing. They'll see that I'm really trying to lead people in the right direction. The opposition will die down. But stay in Galilee. It's pretty here. It's quiet. I've seen it. It's green, verdant, beautiful. But when you go into the hills of Judea, there's a craggy rockiness about it. That must have come through spiritually to Jesus as well. He knew what he was going for. But he set his face to go to Jerusalem. I don't know what the things are that keep you away from the Lord or that have made you decide before now you wouldn't do what you knew you ought to do. But I wish I knew what to say to get you to set your face toward Jerusalem. Tighten that courage. Set your determination to do his will, whatever the cost. Would you? While we sing. Thank you.